Welcome to The One. I'm Greg Gutfeld, a.k.a. The One. By the way, a.k.a. stands for also known as. That's your fact for today. I'm here today with one of my favorite writers, Kevin Williamson. Kevin, the last time I saw you, I think, was in a bar, correct?
Probably. That sounds likely.
Yes. It was a dive bar in Tribeca, which sounds classy, but it really wasn't. It wasn't.
No.
It was,
I don't think it was at all.
It was one of those bars where the door is made of two different types of wood. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I recall the place, yeah.
Yes. But it's like they didn't bother to get a new door. The door got kicked in, so they just put some more wood over the hole in the door, I think.
kind of making do, I think, yeah.
Yes. So, Kevin,
so many reasons I don't live in New York anymore.
Yeah, that's right. Where are you right now, by the way?
I'm in Dallas right now.
Gotcha. So I want to, just so if my listeners aren't aware of what Kevin does, Kevin's National Review's roving correspondent. He's the director of the National Review Institute's William F. Buckley Fellowship Program in Political Journalism. He's wrote a couple of books, including one of my favorite ones, The End Is Near, and It's Going to Be Awesome, How Going Broke Will Leave America Richer, Happier, and More Secure. I read that book. I enjoyed it. I had you on Red Eye a couple of times to talk about it. You have a long, great journalism career, but I kind of look at you as, I call you a step back guy, meaning when there's something going on and there's a lot of stuff going on and I'm caught in the middle of something, like let's say some kind of big issue that's going around. Let's say it's a mass shooting. Let's say it's something going on with Trump. If I read you, I kind of get a big picture because you've kind of stepped back and you always kind of give you reduce the hysteria of the moment into something else. Is that a fair assessment of what you do for a living?
Yeah, I think that would be fair. Also a fair assessment of, why I don't have a television show and my books don't sell that well and that sort of thing.
You're right, though. You're right. If you stay within the hysteria bubble, you can make quite a living on the left and on the right. But if you step back, and this is where I'm going to get to with your latest article. But if you're the person who steps back and says, look, things aren't as bad or as good as people say it is, you're not going to get a lot of viewers. Either it has to be really great or it has to be really bad, depending on the side you're on at that time. And that gets me to your article, which was called "There Will Be No Civil War Today." And I thought it was a great piece. Can you explain what you were saying in it?
Yeah, so I was talking to a guy here in Texas a couple of weeks ago, I was doing some business with, and, kind of normal, professional, educated, well-adjusted guy, conservative, and was interested to know that I wrote for National Review. And in the middle of the conversation, he just takes this weird U-turn into do you know about QAnon? So Q is this author of a kind of popular of the moment online conspiracy theory who he claims to be, some top secret government employee with Q level clearance, hence the name. Mm-hmm. And his story is that these Trump investigations and such are all part of an elaborate ruse into an ongoing national security and law enforcement operation against the Clintons, of course, because we on the right are still always obsessed with the Clintons, right, and some Saudi enablers of theirs and such, and that they're all just about to be arrested, or in some cases they've already been arrested and they're secretly wearing ankle monitors and such things. And so this was supposed to kick off last Sunday with the arrest of John Podesta. Mm-hmm. And there were warnings on Twitter that there were going to be, riots as the, Soros supported left figures out how to create civil discord and try to keep their little cabal in power. Of course, it's all nuts. It's just flatly crazy. But there are people who take this sort of thing seriously. And this is an extreme version of it, but that kind of conspiratorial mindset is very much a part of everyday politics, from the idea that the economy is rigged against poor people, mm-hmm, to the idea that the political and democratic processes are being fixed on the inside by quote-unquote establishment or the elites and such things. So at the far end of conspiracy theory thinking, it's, you know, lizard people and, you know, Bilderbergers and that kind of stuff. And that's all fun to laugh at. But it actually, it does infect the mainstreams of both parties and both tendencies.
Yeah, it is. It's a way to it's a way to explain everything, right? I mean, it's like if you don't have like the world is unfair and strange and every time you think you're right about something, something else happens, or it's just something happens that that doesn't fit into your world. And a conspiracy can explain everything, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and that's on the left. They've spent a long time, hundreds of years, looking for kind of a master villain. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for Marx, it was capitalist exploitation. Then it became patriarchy. Then it became white supremacy, which is very popular at the moment.
Right.
I wrote a piece about this for the magazine a couple of weeks ago about Ta-Nehisi Coates and his argument about white supremacy. And the problem with that line of thinking is that, you know, it explains everything and it's part of everything. So chattel slavery was white supremacy. The fact that there are nice restaurants in Brooklyn now and neighborhoods that didn't have them is also white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
And so if white supremacy explains both of those things, you know, it doesn't explain anything.
Right.
So the left has always been looking for this kind of master villain, and that changes kind of every generation. On the right, there's been a different kind of version of that. So it's communists for a while, of course, and everything that was happening in the world was a communist conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
On the
I still believe that, by the way.
Parts of the rights. Well, yeah, it is. It's you know, Bernie Sanders is right there.
Yes.
And on the nastier parts of the right, you know, it's the Jews, it's mm-hmm. the international bankers, as Henry Ford thought, and that sort of thing. But now the right has settled on, well, everything is George Soros,
mm-hmm.
and everything is the Clintons, the deep state.
Right.
You know, the words deep state is have taken on a great deal of popularity and cachet.
Yeah, it drives me crazy.
Just 2 years ago.
I used it about a year and a half ago, and I still feel a little dirty because I do, you know, it's so weird. It's one of those things. It's also like when you keep calling people globalists, and I get very frustrated when people go, well, I'm glad he got rid of that guy. He was a globalist. And I go, I think that if he had kept him, you would have liked him. But now that he got rid of him, you're just going to call him a globalist. And suddenly everybody that doesn't fit into your world is a globalist. And
right. And, of course, it's another word that doesn't really mean anything.
Yeah. The more you use it. Now, by the way, I also believe we've redrawn the team sport politics. It's no longer conservative liberal. It's globalist deep state versus nationalistic populism, right? Wouldn't you say that's kind of like where what's happening? I think I don't know.
Not exactly, because mm-hmm. there are populist tendencies on both sides, mm-hmm. and they're ascendant on both sides.
Yeah.
So in the Democratic Party, you've got the kind of Sanders Warren school of populism, and it's a lot more like Trumpism than people on the left and the Democratic Party like to admit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went out with Bernie on the campaign trail in 2016, watched him at a number of events, and you know, he would do these union hall events in places like Iowa and engage in this really, really nationalistic populist rhetoric. And he talked about immigration the way Donald Trump talks about mm-hmm. immigration, that it's a plot by billionaires, the Koch brothers, to flood the country with cheap labor and undermine the American working man. You know, this is Bernie Sanders talks mm-hmm. this way. Now, he's toned down his public pronouncements on immigration a little bit recently as the Democrats have swung around on that issue in a different kind of way. But there is that on both sides. I think both parties have an ongoing conflict between the people who are intellectually responsible, who are politically a little bit more sensible, and the people who are the amateurs and the people who are in the entertainment business rather than the politics business.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been particularly difficult, I think, for the Republicans right now, because the entertainment wing of the conservative movement is so powerful and so strong at the moment in a way that it's really not on the Democratic side, which has more of an infrastructure in the form of public sector unions and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. I do think, though, that there is always a possibility that we always hear about the Bitcoin bubble and the internet bubble, the Trump bubble. If that bursts, then a lot of this, we're back to where we were. I have that feeling.
Yeah.
But I want to ask you, you know, when you talk about conspiracy thinking, just if you have any advice, okay, for example, I have a friend who is really smart, engaging conservative, who got pulled into the crisis actor stuff, and it got to, and at that point, I had to cut my losses on it because I just ignored it. I kept ignoring it, and I couldn't ignore. I was like, I'm no longer the person that has to tell this person that their opinion is crazy. I can't do it anymore. Is there a is there a way to shake somebody once they sink their teeth into something? How do you unsink their teeth?
You don't. I mean, you know, individually, people latch onto these things, and they are immune to evidence because it's not really about evidence, and it's not really even about the claim that they're making factually. It's about mood affiliation.
Yeah.
It's about seeing the world as a conspiracy, irrespective of whether this particular conspiracy has any evidence to support it. It's kind of like, you know, you're a conservative. You meet these people all the time. You'll meet a guy who is sort of a self-taught expert on either evolution or global warming, and has this great theory about how, you know, he can prove to you scientifically with the scientific knowledge he picked up in dental school or in accounting school or wherever he went to school about how this stuff is a fraud and how it's the scientific journals are colluding to keep that stuff out of there. You can talk to them all day. You can show them all the evidence. It won't change their minds.
Yeah. And also the thing that is they some of the evidence that they present are just pictures with arrows drawn on them. Do you know what I mean?
It's like,
it's like if you circle something and put an arrow and then put it to another picture, an arrow, it triggers something in the brain that makes it feel like you're learning something or getting a valuable piece of information, and it could be complete not. I remember reading conspiracy books in the 70s, like None Dare Call a Conspiracy. I remember like Chariots of the Gods. Diagrams and charts and little things like that go a long way to convince you, right? More than anything, I think.
Yeah, you know, and it's I read. I spend a lot of time reading kind of right wing survivalist novels. This kind of, you know, fantasy literature about the end of the world and how the small band of patriots gets together. I've been meaning to write an essay on this for a long time. I think it's kind of an interesting, weird subgenre of literature and. You know, it's kind of about projecting certain kinds of desires onto the political system and onto the social system. And the difference is you just get – when it's your grandmother doing it on Twitter or your grandmother doing it on Facebook. Grandma's on Facebook, not Twitter.
Yeah,
and she's got less of a sense of, you know, panache and irony about it. But what's interesting to me about that is if you look at this, you know, kind of crazy right-wing militia survivalist literature, you know, your hipsters in Brooklyn would turn their noses up at that. But they're all, you know, watching zombie apocalypse movies and The Walking Dead, which is the same thing.
That's
except
true.
It's got a slight, you know, sheen of hipsterdom on top of it.
That's a good point. That's true. Do you think that the like I keep hearing about tribalism, and I feel like it's I believe that maybe it's getting worse because people are going into their specific groups that make them feel good. But when I read your article, and I'm going, okay, is it actually really worse today than it was before? Are we drifting into our own camps and becoming, I don't know, destined to meet violently in the future?
No, I think that we stew in it a little bit more because of social media and the general availability of media. You know, you think about when I was growing up in Lubbock in the 1970s, you're still three television stations, three network newscasts, one newspaper, and that was all the media that you had, you know, radio maybe. And so once that was your entire media diet, and you consumed that, and that was that. And so you didn't maybe spend as much time thinking about it. These are diseases of affluence, I think, that we are in very prosperous and largely peaceable times, and they're actually kind of boring times. I think that we will look back on this 200 years from now as the kind of, you know, Grover Cleveland, James Blaine kind of era, where not a lot of really interesting stuff happened in our politics because, you know, things are actually going reasonably well. We always want to convince ourselves we're living in the most important and consequential times, but we're going to look back at this as a time when we were so unserious about this stuff that we were selecting presidents just as cultural totems, essentially, which is what Donald Trump is and what Barack Obama was before him. You know, George W. Bush may end up being the last president who is a real politician in that sense for a long time. And people joke about, you know, Oprah and things like that, but we should not joke about that because it will come to pass.
I agree. I think that there may be no turning back, actually, because now we are trained to look for this type of person, and the person that used to be there before just seems boring or just not up to speed. If you can't keep up with a Trump or an Oprah on that stage of 16 other people, you're not going to. America's not going to be interested after the Trump show. That's the opening act. There's no, I mean, how do you follow that up?
I think that as times get more serious, and they will, that it's likely that the people will become a little more serious too.
Yeah. You know, speaking of serious times, because you talk about being in boring times. Okay. I want to ask you about the two things that I think about the most. One of them is I do believe the Islamic threat is actually it's to me probably the most the biggest important problem, because they are radical Islam is seeking, you know, the end of the earth because the other world is so much better. So they're never going to quit. Mm-hmm. And I might think about it too much. I have friends who think I'm crazy. I think about it the way people think about climate change. I think about it too much.
Yeah.
But the other threat, so you can address that one and tell me I'm overestimating it. And then artificial intelligence, which I've been, you know, talking a lot about, and that seems to be something that is inevitable and could dwarf our existence as the machines become so much smarter. And I'm wondering if I've just become too crazy.
Well, I don't think artificial intelligence will ever be a match for organic stupidity in terms of our problems.
Yeah.
But the Islamic threat is real, and it is our leading security threat in the world right now.
Mm-hmm.
But compared with, say, the Soviet Union, which had, you know, a gigantic army and tanks and a state and nuclear weapons and that sort of thing, it's not as big a deal. We're talking about, a couple of relatively well organized bands of angry desert savages who are in thrall to a kind of primitive fanaticism, and that's going to be a problem. And technology amplifies the individual in our time, both to do good and to do ill. So it's possible for one person to do a lot more damage than they used to. Although, again, we've had serious acts of terrorism like that in American history going way back. And then the Bath school bombing is something that I always kind of think about.
Mm-hmm.
When people talk about school massacres as a new thing, this was, 1905 or whenever that was.
Still the biggest one, I believe, right? The biggest.
Yeah, I think it's the biggest school massacre in American history still. No guns involved, just a bunch of bombs.
Right.
Disappointed politician.
Yep.
So that is a problem. It's something we have to think about. And it's a problem not because I expect that the United States government is going to be overthrown by a bunch of jihadists, but because terrorism has the power to compel us to change the way that we live.
Mm-hmm.
And it already has in important ways. And I think that is something that actually contributes to this current moment of paranoia and tribalism and that sort of thing. And, I was a couple years ago, I was watching Mad Men.
Mm-hmm.
And the most shocking scene in Mad Men is when Don Draper walks into JFK and walks up to a counter and says, "I want to be on a flight to Los Angeles in 20 minutes and writes them a check and then goes and gets on the airplane. And I'm like, man, things have changed.
Yes.
And not for the better in that way. Not mm-hmm. for the better in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of things that are radically better than they were 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago in terms of our material standard of living. Someone was pointing out the other day in the novel of Casino Royale, Ian Fleming wants to demonstrate how sophisticated Bond is, and he has him order an avocado on his date with Vesper Lynd. Because an avocado was such an exotic thing that you did that when you were at a place like Casino Royale and you're wearing a tuxedo and you're James Bond, not something you picked up at, Whole Foods for $1.86 or whatever they cost.
God, that's fantastic.
So those little things in life that get radically better that we fail to appreciate because we're so immersed in them that they become invisible to us, whereas relatively minor things, and I do think that the threat of radical Islam is relatively minor compared to, say, Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union or something like that.
My only exception, my exception to that is the numerical. There's a numerical significance that didn't exist before. Like one person could not take out thousands. But I just feel that if you get one person who knows how to put together a dirty bomb and a drone, then you've got a stadium-sized massacre. So that's what I think about that too much because I know that It's going to happen. And so like some obscure person becomes numerically way more significant.
Yeah.
You know, but that's my thing. I want to ask you about go ahead.
That's the sort of thing that'll keep you up at night if you spend very much time thinking about it. You know, one of the things that amazes me, and it's very relevant to your part of the world, is that there's still no security on Amtrak, essentially.
I agree. I think about this all the time. I when I get on the train, I don't understand why no one has addressed this.
I mean, if you wanted to really kick the American political and media class right in the scrotum and ensure maximum coverage, you would think the Acela would be what you'd want to bomb.
There's something about – I don't know what it is, but I get very nervous when I'm on it because I just go, nobody checks me. Nobody does.
Yeah.
And nobody checks anybody. And if you're in the train station, everything is so chaotic. But maybe there's something I keep thinking there's something we don't know about. That there's an invisible security that they're not mentioning because they don't want people to know that they're on top of it. In fact, they might see everything. I tell this to myself every time I get on the train. And I also say, okay, play the odds, Greg. It's not going to happen. But it is something that I think about. I got to go, but I wanted to – because I told you I'd only keep you for 22 and a half minutes. And I think I've already gone – so my last concern was artificial intelligence. I know you're up on everything, so you must be up on the pro and the con of whether it's going to kill the human race completely or enhance it.
I think that the technological disturbance isn't going to be artificial intelligence so much as it's going to be the things that artificial intelligence really enables. Mm-hmm. And one of those things is immersive pornography, which mm-hmm. I think will basically change our society in very deep and fundamental ways.
Really? Expand.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that is a virtual reality virtual reality pornography
Well, there's that. There's also the ever more lifelike and expensive sex robots and that sort of thing.
Yes.
And throughout human history, what's really driven young men to work and innovate and excel is their sex drive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the hunting for a mate kind of thing. And once that gets taken off the table as a biological imperative, I think you're going to see an even worse state of American manhood than you have right now. And then we will look back wistfully on this generation of, guys playing video games and smoking dope, but at least they, had a job and maybe got out of the house once or twice a week. I think it's going to be something that will be really innervating for us.
You know, I'm thinking about this, and I always – I think, like, if you look at the way – we sell organic now. It's like because everybody – like when you're selling something organic, it's based against this plastic fake society. It's like we only serve whole grain bread and organic eggs and
– Quinoa.
Quinoa. I have a feeling that wouldn't sex also rebel in the same way that we'll have – it'll be considered organic for humans? It'll be like –
I think as you probably know, you've seen me write about this, but David Foster Wallace is my favorite writer, my favorite modern writer anyway. I think he was a bit of a prophet. And he's got a wonderful short story called Datum Centurio, and it's a short story in the form of a dictionary entry from the future mm-hmm. for the word date. And as you read through the different definitions and etymologies of the word date, what you come to discover is that in the future, people only have sex for the purpose of procreation because pornography has become so immersive and so preferred to ordinary sex. And, David Foster Wallace always puts footnotes in his work. And the last footnote is CF, Catholic dogma, comma, perverse vindication of.
It's true, isn't it? A buddy of mine who was a big-time Catholic sent me a book called Sexual Renunciation, which is what that is. Isn't that what it is? Sexual is only having sex for procreation. That's it. Except –
Yeah, that's
without the pornography
teaching.
What?
But I guess there are some people who I guess go down that route. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Kevin, always a pleasure. One of these days you're going to get out here and do the show. It's been a long time. The GG
has been,
show.
Yeah.
You're always moving. How long have you been in Texas for?
Well, I live here at the moment, so this is home for now.
That's the name of your next book should be At the Moment, because you're always moving.
At the moment.
So, but people can find you. You're on National Review. on the website. I always read your stuff, and again, pick up his book. Is The End Is Near, and it's going to be awesome. And he also has a very strong anti-Trump book, which we won't plug for obvious reasons. I'm joking. Anyway.
That's because they won't let you.
No, I can say whatever I want, Kevin, I'll have you know. I just choose not to say certain things. Anyway, Kevin, have fun. Talk to you soon, I hope.
All right. Take care, Greg.